in yet another outbreak of fiscal rectitude, we have now the Labour Party effectively repeating what the Conservatives have been saying, that the days of ever more debt are over and we're going to return to a path which is gradually going to bring down debt and only borrow for investment and not for current expenditure. Nothing particularly new in that, but what is new is the vivid way in which Labour wants to embrace that particular philosophy. But like many previous governments, the words are not quite what they seem. Sounds too good to be true that we have cross-party consensus on a return to what one might call conventional and serious economic management. But in practice, it's really a bit different. It's a bit like saying, you know, oh Lord, I really do promise to be good this time, but not just quite yet. And when I say good, I really don't mean exactly what you might think the word good is. I mean, in a way which allows me plenty of wriggle room in order to actually carry on very much as before. So I want you to believe me, and I want the bond markets to believe me, but I wonder whether in fact I'm going to be able to deliver what I say I'm going to deliver, and therefore, look, I'm going to give myself all sorts of get-out-of-jail cards. So let's have a look at just how much wriggle room there is and what these new fiscal rules mean, both for Labour and indeed the current ones for the Conservatives. What sounds to be incredibly sensible and goes back, you know, to Gordon Brown and actually back to effectively Ken Clark in the end of the 1990s, is that borrowing is about investment. Who could disagree with that? You know, investment creates new assets, borrowing creates liabilities, and as long as the assets are good economic ones to invest in, you know, the governments are good at picking winners and good at ensuring that what they do doesn't deliver government failure, but only addresses market failure, then, you know, what could anyone object to that for? So we're all on that ticket. The second thing is, we're all on the ticket of debt's got to come on a downward path. We pushed up from, you know, the kind of 36% of debt to GDP, which Tony Blair and Gordon Brown inherited in the 1990s, 1997, when they won their landslide. We pushed up to nearly 100%. We're on 90-something percent. And, okay, this is going to be the tops. And what's going to happen is, by the end of the parliament, debt's going to be on a downward path. And, you know, we are going to make the current balance add up. So current expenditure is going to equal current revenue. So we're not going to borrow for day-to-day spending. That's where we've got to. And if you look at that, it looks as if it's okay. Some wriggle room, a bit of manipulation, a perfectly reasonable argument from Labour that when they get into power, they can't immediately cut, for example, public expenditure to meet the current spending must be from current revenue rule. So it'll take a bit of time. And anyway, from Labour's perspective, don't worry, because we're going to have the fastest growth rate in the G7 by the end of the parliament, when debt's supposed to be coming down and these rules are supposed to be fully met. And when, you know, we've got to that point of, you know, what, 4, 5, 6% growth, the money's going to come tumbling into the Treasury. And actually, by the election after this one coming up, Labour should in that world be able to tell the world that actually it's exceeded these fiscal rules and been even more righteous in what it's been doing. Well, if something looks too good to be true, it probably is. And it does look too good to be true to believe that either political party have really discovered the path of righteousness and really intend to stick to it. And why is that the case? Well, it's the case because when you look at the rules, there's just enormous wriggle room. Indeed, there's so much wriggle room that the rules themselves don't really mean much. I mean, you couldn't imagine Labour saying in the run-up to the election, vote for us, we're going on a spending spree, and we're going to borrow for current spending, and we're going to borrow for investment, and we're going to increase the national debt, et cetera, et cetera. You couldn't imagine them saying that. They're bound to say something like this, and so are the Conservatives. But why should they be relaxed about saying this? Well, the answer is that not only do they have the wriggle room from now to 29 to 30 to say, well, you know, we told you we'd do this by the end of the parliament, and so, you know, it's always going to be next year, and hope by 2:30 events have come up so that people have forgotten about holding them fully to account for the rules they signed up in 2:24. That's one possible way of looking at it. But another is to look behind the rules themselves. So when someone says to you, look, I'm only going to borrow to invest, but I'm not for current consumption, then what you should do is ask a very simple question. So how do you define current spending, and how do you define investment? Because the obvious incentive this creates is to call anything and everything you possibly can investment rather than current spending, and then you can borrow for it, it's fine. There's form on this. I mean, Gordon Brown famously was engaged in redefining health and education as investment, not current spending. And if you shift enough things over to the investment box, then you're going to meet your current spending rule, and you don't have any borrowing rule in respect of investment. So that's a pretty good way of getting around what's been advocated. And how would you do that? Well, the big ticket in the borderline between current spending and investment is capital maintenance. That's everything from fixing the holes, the potholes in the road, patching them up, about fixing the roofs in the schools and the hospitals, about maintaining the highways more generally, maintaining the railways, and so on and so forth. And if you look around Britain today, you'll see that the current state of our infrastructure in particular is pretty awful. I mean, nobody comes here and invests in the UK thinking, wow, great, I'm going to have these fantastic infrastructures which are going to support what I need done. On the contrary, it's pretty dismal. It's not quite true that everything's broken, but many people feel like that, and there's a grain of truth that lies behind it. So let's take school roofs. Now, you would think that in order to provide the service in perpetuity of a decent education, you need school buildings, and they need roofs on them, and they're not supposed to leak. And for a long time, these roofs have not been properly maintained. We know that with respect to the rack concrete, that because they're very vulnerable to what happens if water penetrates them, leakage really matters on roofs, and frankly, they haven't been fixed. So we should pay out of current income, current spending, to make sure that these assets are not deteriorating. It's not investment to repair the roofs that are in this state. It's capital maintenance on a day-to-day basis. And when you look across what's required in the UK, it really is a very large catch-up in capital maintenance, patching up the damage, fixing the roads, etc. And these numbers are very large. So what do the national statistics do when it comes to sorting out what's capital maintenance and therefore current spending, and what is capital expenditure, investment, and therefore under these rules can be backed up by borrowing? Well, answer, the ONS statistics say that anything that's done which has an asset life of less than a year is capital maintenance, and everything else is investment. So it's not hard to imagine a government up against the wall of its so-called fiscal rules and basically relabeling a huge amount of stuff that ought to be capital maintenance and current spending as capital investment, and therefore getting out of the borrowing rules and being able to borrow as much as it takes to do what is current spending on capital maintenance as if it's investment. And they have the get out of jail card in addition. They say, oh, well, the ONS qualifies it in these terms, and that's their classification, so we're just following the rules again. Well, what that tells you is the ONS definition isn't very sensible, and it tells you that However much you might say you're following what the ONS says, the reality is you're borrowing and making future generations pay for stuff that we, the current generation, should be doing as a day-to-day housekeeping exercise to fix the tiles on the roof, fix the potholes, and so on and so forth. And this is true across the economy. All sorts of capital maintenance in water companies with their sewage works and their water treatment works and their pipes, all sorts of stuff on the railways, all sorts of stuff in the electricity system is really capital maintenance that's going on and needed and has been neglected. And it's all going to be called investment instead. And that's why we end up with this very large borrowing without actually enhancing the assets at the end of the day. Hiding behind statistical rules where the rules don't make a lot of sense is not a good way of being a good steward of the economy and making sure that the next generation only inherits debt where it also inherits enhanced assets, rather than inheriting debt for patching up what should have been fixed in the first place by the current generation. That's a big get out of jail card. It's not the only one, because when we come to talk about, you know, borrowing for investment, we have to be clear who that borrowing's from. And in most successful economies with high growth rates, unless they just go for a consumer boom or an asset bubble, there is domestic savings which provide the funds in order to be used to provide the debt in order to do the investment. The UK doesn't have any net savings after capital depreciation. It looks like we have some savings, but what those savings are offset by is the fact that we're eating up our capital stock rather than maintaining it through time. And this might sound a little esoteric and a little techy, but the reality is that we live and borrow at the bequest and kindness of strangers, and those strangers are providing for us the investment which, in a stable economy, should come from domestic savers in large or considerable part. After all, if you aspire to be one of the fastest growing economies in the G7, and therefore in principle in the world, you might have a look at how other countries have managed that, how they've done reindustrializations, transformations, and so on. And they've done it through high domestic savings, high exports, and relying on those domestic savers to set aside from consumption what's needed for investment. There is no prospect whatsoever in either of the parties' plans of actually stimulating domestic savings. So when you look at these fiscal rules, the reality is that the scope for fudge is extremely large, and the incentives go towards fudging in a way which is not a proper dealing with the next generation. It's not fair what we're doing to them. We're actually going to borrow for capital maintenance and therefore for current consumption concerns rather than for investment. And so what will happen? Well, one possibility is that both parties really mean it. And then if the rules are tight and they're binding, we should expect quite sharp reductions in current expenditure. And that means reductions in spending on health, education, so on and so forth. And particularly reductions in spending on welfare payments. Neither party are really promising to do that. So if you can't control current expenditure and you set yourself these binding fiscal rules and you promise the debt markets, the bond markets, that you really are going to stop sinning and you don't deliver it, there's only one thing left to do, which unfortunately is cut the investment, cut the capital expenditure. And that's what almost every government's done for the last 30 or 40 years, whenever it's run into public expenditure trouble. Well, we might not run into those difficulties because we may have the highest growth rate in the G7. But if I was in the bond market or I was concerned about the generational deal from us to the next generation, I wouldn't bank on us having the highest growth rate in the G7 at the end And I wouldn't, at the end of the decade, and I wouldn't bank on that being sufficient to bail out these fiscal rules so that we do, in fact, have a lower debt-to-GDP ratio in 2030 than we have today. We are actually balancing the current books, and it's only genuine enhancement investment for which borrowing is being added to the balance sheet. Who knows? But fiscal rectitude is easier to announce than it is to deliver. Thank you.